Hi, I'm Bill Roop. I'm an alcoholic. After hearing Don project himself over this microphone, I feel you're going to get a shallow imitation. You know, they go at great lengths. Here a gentleman who has been a leader in the group out here, Jay, Mr. Jay, he passed on just so I could talk tonight, which was real decent of him. And got to thank him for that. But I was just thinking when, in fact, I wrote something down because I have a, if I can find it. Some of this has been covered, I guess, but I want to thank Lynn Yarbrough and the committee for our invitation and also the basket of goodies. I always forget to thank people. And if the Georgia 50th prepaid was started 4 years before I even came into AA. That's a long time of a continuous group or convention. And free. That is amazing. I'm sure a lot of people said it couldn't be done. But you not only had done it, but you're still doing it. I remember somewhere in my memory that some people wanted to discontinue the Georgia prepaid. And if I remember correctly, this is going way back, and I'm sure it goes on a lot. Clarence Roberts and some other people were very adamant that it would continue. And I think Georgia prepaid convention is the only free convention, prepaid free convention in the United States. And it's something Georgia can be proud of. Don already mentioned that we're a bunch of miracles, and I want to tell you, I want to welcome you to Miracle Land USA because you are miracles. You know, 20 million alcoholics, 2 million of them are, 2 million of us are sober in AA. These are rough approximations. That means 9 out of 10 people that have the disease of alcoholism are going to die in an institution or in a nut house, in a jail, however, but they don't have to. What I'm going to share with you tonight, and I share that at a prison meeting I go to every Thursday night, because, and there's usually Gary Neidhart. I got to mention some people, Gary Neidhart, Pat Wheeler, Bowen David, Chet. If I don't mention their name, they won't come. Oh, yeah. Dan Page and his wife. They told me they'd come if I mentioned their name. My pigeons don't have any egos. But what I'm going to share with you tonight is just the way AA has been in the life of Bill Roop and his wife, Janet. My wife's got 45 years of sobriety. I'd like to have you give her a hand, because she's... I said just a hand. You have to give her a hand and a foot. My gosh, I don't get that applause. You're right, Jan. Hear what she said? She says, I'm the important. I love that woman. So what I'm going to share with you just the way AA was worked in the life of Bill Roop. Not the way it should work in your life or the way it's going to work. But it's kept me sober and very important. I wish I could say that the reason I was had character defects is because I drank, but that's not so. I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief before I ever drank. I was a liar because I didn't like my lot in life, and I tried to be somebody I wasn't when I was a kid. I played basketball, but I always had to lie about being better than I was. I always said we came during the Depression. People would say we came from a lower middle class neighborhood, I guess, or upper or low class. And a lot of kids weren't going to college. A lot of kids weren't going to college back in those days. But old Bill Roop was. He told me he was going to college. There was no chance of me going to college. It was a depression day. My uncle had got fired. I was raised by my uncle and aunt. My dad, I wasn't living with him or with his family. I felt inadequate. I felt that I was unworthy. I felt abandoned. So I had to be somebody I wasn't, so I lived a lie as a young kid. I stole money from the Baptist church. My aunt used to give put a nickel in on the, for the church and nickel for the missions. And I would take the nickel from the missions and go over and buy candy. And at that time, you'd get a big bag of candy for a nickel. And I'd pass it out to my friends. And they thought I came from a wealthy family. But I was just buying friends. I figured they wouldn't like me if I couldn't give them something. So I was an adequate person before I ever discovered booze. And my wife and I met at the Northern Trust Company in Chicago. I broke her in her job. And she was a very beautiful, and is a very beautiful woman. And I felt inadequate around her because when you're in my neighborhood, I grew up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood. And when you're a hook-nosed Baptist, you know discrimination, because Irish Catholics only talk to Irish Catholics. They don't talk to Polish Catholics, Italian Catholics. So hook-nosed Baptists, they were the only part of him. But it stood me in good stead because I played basketball. My hook nose came in handy because I played on the B'nai B'rith team. They thought I was Jewish, and they could only have one outside player that wasn't a Jew. So I could play, and they didn't count me as an outsider. I was a Jew there. I played with the Catholic in the CYO league in that, and then I played with the Church of God, and I played with the Baptists. So I was an ecumenical basketball player, and it was very important to me because this is where I found my fellowship, is in church. When I met Janet, I was president of the Baptist Young People's Union in Chicago and active in my church, and she stopped all that. I would have been the saint that I am today earlier if I hadn't married that Irishman. But beauty will have you do weird things, you know. I broke her in on her job. We won a basketball tournament in the city, and I was asked to, who I was going to take to the dance, and I said, I don't know. They said, why don't you take Burke? I used to call her Burke the Jerk. With that sort of an entree, you can see that I'm a very qualified person with the ladies. Don't laugh, it was good enough to get me married, you know. But so I turned to Janet and I said, would you like to go to dance? And she said, yes, I would. And we've been going together ever since. That's over 60 years. You know that they say in the Bible that if you live together long enough, you become one flesh. So if you become one flesh, then your years should count as one. So we've got 120 years of marriage. We've got 91 years of sobriety. Very few people around have got that, you know. It's 45 years. Jan's correcting me. But we've had a lot of fun together, but we had a lot of fights together. When you take two weird people and stick them together, I fell in love with her because she was a beautiful Irish lady. And she fell in love with me, I think, because I was gregarious. A lot of people like me. You know, people, you can't get by on your looks when you're inadequate. You've got to develop a personality. So I always got involved with things and liked people. And she married me, I think, because she figured that she was sort of a loner. And this would bring in a lot of people in her life. And then I married her because she fulfilled the Irish part. And she was also beautiful. And I didn't feel I was worthy. But we got married. Neither one of us drank. After games, we'd go out and have ice cream, sodas. World War II came along, and I volunteered, as most everybody else did, and I went away to training. And she came up to visit me in Ashland, Wisconsin. And when, in April of that year, 1942, I think it was, we got married. Or 43, I don't know, 42. Anyway, we got married, and these two people that didn't have any, I didn't know how to live. I didn't have any ace in the hole. I didn't have any training. We got married. We had a child before I went overseas. And when I left, I was still, I didn't drink much. I drank a little bit, but not much. And 3 years later, when I came home, I was an alcoholic. And the amazing thing was, my wife, who didn't go overseas, she was an alcoholic too. I don't know if there's any of you fellows here that are ever in the Navy. If there is, I want to thank you for helping my wife become an alcoholic, because they had a naval training center right near her, and they were nice enough to expose my wife to the joys of bar drinking, for which I'll be eternally grateful. Anchors away, fellas, you know. But so I come back from overseas, and I'm an alcoholic, and this is all in hindsight. When I first came in AA, I thought I was alcoholic only for the last couple of years, when I finally decided I was an alcoholic. But I was an alcoholic from the time I really started to drink. It changed my perspective, changed my perception. It made me capable of doing anything. But when we got home, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like. Because Don and Joan are married, and my pigeon Ross and his wife. And Don just gave me an honor, and he asked me to be his sponsor. Now, most people, God sends me to sponsor. In the long run, they help me. So I'm looking at Don wondering, what the hell is he going to help me with, you know? But I'm sure it's something big. But, incidentally, a lot of people don't know this. I wasn't going to accept him as a pigeon till I found out that the fellow who introduced me tonight is a one-star general and an admiral. And a humble guy like him. Obviously, I'd take him as a pigeon. Most of my pigeons aren't even corporals. And if any of you are wondering how you can be a one-star general and an admiral and have conflicting uniforms, he wasn't in the Cuban Army. It was in the American Navy and Army. Ask him about it later. It's fast. Or if he's too humble to tell you, Joan will fill you in. But I digress. I do that a lot. I think it's 81. I've reached 81, and sometimes I get carried away. But anyway, we got married, came back, and had a baby. And when I left to go overseas, there was no place to live, so Jan moved in with her mother-in-law. And they moved into a one-bedroom, third-story. It was a dinette kitchenette, living room, and a one-bedroom. And I moved in there, so there was my mother-in-law, my daughter Peggy, my wife, and I in this room, in this apartment. And then I made a second mistake. I went to DePaul University, which is a Catholic university. And the Catholic will get you by osmosis. You don't even have to be professing. They'll get you. At the end of my freshman year, there was my mother-in-law, my daughter Peggy, my son John, my wife, and I in the one-bedroom apartment. At the end of my sophomore year, there was my daughter Peggy, my son John, my son Bill, my mother-in-law, my wife, and I, one-bedroom. At the end of my senior year, there was my mother-in-law, my daughter Peggy, my son John, my son Bill, my son Richard, my wife and I in a one-bedroom apartment. And my wife used to bitch. I was away at school solving big problems, and I'd come home to this nagging shrew I was married to. I'll give you an example of what life was like. I remember one time I went and got her a lemon cream pie. I guess it was banana cream, I guess it was. Had nice meringue on it. And when I left school and I was going down, I naturally stopped in the bar at the IC Railroad in Chicago to show the people what I was bringing home to my wife. That was about 6 o'clock at night. And a couple of them said, let's cut the pie. I said, no, you can't touch this. You know, it was like I was protecting her virginity. No, you touch it. And at 7 o'clock in another bar, somebody said the same thing, and I again sallied forth to defend the pie. This went on 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. I finally rolled in at 4 in the morning, and I walked in with her unsullied pie. She raised hell with me. Just terrible shrieking. It made me so mad, I took that pie and I fired it at the wall, and it stuck. The meringue had got like glue. Boom. And Jan and I started to laugh. That was one of our fun nights. I'll just give you another one. Some people have asked me to share this with you. If you marry an Irishman, they yell a lot. You're Irish, aren't you, Don? Yeah. No. There must have been in the background. Scotch, anyway. They yell a lot, and they also fight a lot. And I was Baptist. And you know, we Baptists, we don't sin facing each other. And So one night I'd been out for 2 days, and I came home only because I was too exhausted and tired and my nerves were shot, and I had to get some rest. If I had any life, I'd have stayed out. And she started nagging me and just raising hell, just driving me nuts. And being a good husband, I said, okay, dear, I'll take you out. We went to the neighborhood bars, and all the guys that were I was out with, they married future Al-Anons, and once they got yelled at, they let them sleep. The place was dull. Every place was boring. She was right. So when we get home, she continues the attack upon me, just raising hell. And I finally had it. So in a service, they taught us one time in a training, if we wanted to capture a prisoner, we could lay a German prisoner, lay him on his stomach and then sit on his buttocks, tie a rope around his feet and tie it tight, tie his hands up, and then you got to switch your butter and grab him by the hair and pull his head back and tie it. So he's bowed. Now, they don't like you doing that, so they yell. And what you do then, you take a gag and you stick it in their mouth. And I just got done doing this to my wife. And the kids were all watching. Mother-in-law was there. Mother-in-law's yelling, God is love, God is love. She was right, but her timing was terrible. And there were two of Chicago's finest cops standing there. One cop says to me, he says, what he's going to do, and I'm telling him I'm a lawyer, no, you don't have any right to be in my house, I never invited you, I don't know why you're here, and as soon as I get my gun, I'm going to run you off. The other cop's out in the kitchen, which is about 3 centimeters away, and he's going like this. I said, what the hell do you want? He says, how do you do that? So I've been going around the country trying to show them the holes and the knots, you know, help all I can. That was another fun night. You know what I made a mistake? I married into an Irish family. See, no Baptist would call the police, but my mother-in-law had a drunken husband. She knew what to do with a drunk. She called the cops. That's how he got in my house. Now, I better straighten you out right away because sometimes I forget. I'm only a lawyer when I drink. So don't come up in any cases afterwards. I told us at the detention center, and I forgot to tell them that I'm only a lawyer when I'm drinking. You should have seen their eyes light up. A couple of them approached me. I'd like to talk to you for a minute. And I said, I'm pretty expensive. That drove them off. Well, we had so much fun drinking. I graduated from DePaul, and when I did, we moved out to Park Forest, Illinois. There's a guy from Park Forest right here, Bowen David. I don't know if any of you ever mentioned him. He's a rotten fellow, terrible. I met him about my first year. I was sober, I think it was the first year. And he was the head of the symphony orchestra. You know, a drunken head of a symphony orchestra. That's terrible, isn't it? Shouldn't do that. You shouldn't drink if you're a violinist. You shouldn't drink. It's bad enough we got a bass player up here that's a drunk without having a violinist too. But at any rate, so I used to help him. I'll tell you a little story about Bowen to show you what life was like back in those days. Bowen got drunk at odd times. I think it was Christmas. Was it Christmas or Easter, Bowen? Christmas. And when at that time there was no hospitals to take people to and that sort of thing. So we had a few doctors stashed around who would shoot somebody with B-12 if he needed it. So Bowen was in bad shape. His wife called me, and I, on Christmas morning, went over and got him. And I called a doctor. And this doctor was an Irish Catholic doctor. And he said, Bill, I'm taking everybody to Mass. The kids, the 5 kids are here. My wife's here. I can't go dealing any drunk. I can't. On Christmas Day, I said, go and tell Christ how you're helping his kids. He'll love to hear it. He says, okay, you son of a bitch, bring him over. So I brought him over, and the 5 kids were standing there, and the wife was standing there, and Bowen was draped over the hood of the car, and the doctor took his pants down and shot him. Now, that didn't get Bowen sober. He had to go out to California to get sober, but it was a start anyway. And to show, tell you another thing about this guy that's even worse. He came up to me, because when I came on the program, I owed everybody money. Money just was like sand on a rat hole, disappeared. He came up to me and says, "Bill, you seem to have money problems. Would you like some money?" I said, "Hell yes, you know." He said, "I don't have any myself, but I'll go down to friendly Bob Adams and borrow some. Now, what I'd like you to do is, if you can't pay it, just tell me, because my wife doesn't know about it, and she'll get really irritated, and I'll get into trouble. Don't worry about a thing." So time went on. I'm making the payments, one or two or three, whatever it was. It was only, I don't know, $300 or $400. And what did it make? And then Bowen moved to California. And for some reason, I forgot about those payments. I owed so much, I stopped paying. Bowen was gone, out of sight, out of mind. Time goes by, about 10, 12 years. I'm speaking at a podium in Atlanta. And after the meeting, a guy comes up to me and says, "Do you remember me?" I said, "Yes, you're Bowen David. I owe you $200, and I'll give you a check right now." See, you can't get away from them. Move to Atlanta. They'll move to Atlanta. You might as well pay your debts to get you anyway. Bowen told a story, which is a great story. He said, the first guy that met him when he moved to Los Angeles was a collection agent from friendly Bob Adams. Says, "You owe some money." He says, "For what?" Bowen never owed anything. He said, "Well, you co-signed for a guy named Bill Roop who ain't paying, and you got to pay." And Bowen really got irritated, really got mad. You know, he doesn't have a lot of human kindness in him. And he really got mad. And another guy came from Park Forest and saw Bowen. He said, "Did you hear about Roop?" And he said, "No, what happened?" He said, "He got killed. He ran his car into a train, got killed." And Bowen felt so bad about it, because here he'd been thinking bad thoughts about me, and I was dead. And then he comes to Atlanta, and he sees me up on the podium. Son of a bitch ain't dead. They'll get you. No, Bowen's a great guy. Anyway, back to... So I start actively getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I come off a drunk on... So over the weekends before January 3rd, 1957, when I came into AA. And two guys came over to my house, made the phone call. One guy shook his head like this when he was sitting there. I thought he was goofy. I knew he was a pianist. Pianists are somebody that you slip $5 and tell them to play Melancholy Baby while you're romancing some broad. You don't associate with them. Seems like my life is made up of people that are in the orchestras, you know, in bands. Anyway, this guy was Art Hodes, one of the best Dixieland jazz band in the United States. He's dead now. I can mention names because they're all dead. And the other guy was John Handley. He said he was a general foreman in a steel mill, and he used to hide bottles in his locker. And I thought, Jesus, now I'm going to have to hang around with Pollocks from the steel mills. I should never have made that phone call. But being a Baptist, I figured you'd call a minister, you ought to go to church once. So I went to a speaker's meeting like this at Wednesday in Chicago Heights, Illinois. Some guy's up there running his mouth, didn't impress me. Bunch of kids, bunch of women. That's like any Baptist church on Wednesday. Kids and women are around. I figured I've had enough of this. But on the way home, before I left, the guy said, "Would you mind if Jack Murray drove you home?" Now, Jack Murray's dead, too. Don't worry about anonymity. They're all dead. You live to be 81, most of them are dead, you know. Anyway, so Jack Murray took me home. Now, he drove a great big Packard automobile with those great big wheel mounts on the side where they kept a spare tire. Beautiful car, headlights coming out the... Beautiful. He used to play cards with a fellow who was a senator in the state of Iowa. He knew the president that came from Iowa. He also... knew Daly. He's more my type of guy. He asked if he could take me home. I said, sure. So when we get out to a country estate that I'd been evicted to, he said, "Bill, I think it'd be a good idea if you went to a closed meeting." And I said, "Jack, I have a company I'm running, and I really don't have time for that." I think it was wonderful hearing a guy talk, but I don't... And he started jabbing me with a cigar, and I'm ducking him, you know. And I finally started to laugh, and I said, "I'll go." And boy, there was a... greatest statement I ever made in my life. I went to the closed meeting, which was Homewood 17. Not too many women there. They were too profane. Homewood 17 was a lot like all the bars I went to. All guys, all telling lies, swearing like mad. You know, I fit right in. I'd have had some weird things. I remember one time I was at a meeting and a guy had a blonde girl up against the wall and he was talking to her, so I sidled over to find out how you pick up a girl in AA, even though I was married, you know, and in case I needed it. But and what he was saying to the girl, he says, "Gert, the reason you can't stay sober is you don't have a higher power." I thought, gee, that's a hell of a pickup line. I never thought of that. I should have tried that at the Dawn Club. "Hey, baby, you want to talk about God?" You know. But they did things differently. And at this first meeting, a guy comes up to me and he said, "Bill, can you stay away from a drink for 24 hours? And I said, "Why would I want to do that? Our life sucked. We're two drunks, five kids, still got the kids, lost a mother-in-law somewhere, but she came back. But got the five kids, and they're happy. And even the kids today tell you it was a great period in their life. They're living in a farm, and got thrown out of one place, got another one." So, well, I guess I'll have to close. I forgot what I was saying. It happened. She's got Alzheimer's. I just can't remember anything, you know. But what was I talking about? Are you listening? Come on, give me a clue. Okay, so why would you want to not drink, you know? "Can you stay away from a drink for 24 hours? I said, "Yeah, but why would I want to do that?" He said, "Because based on our experience, if you do that, your life will get better." And that's why I came in AA. For the first year or so, and I spoke ever since I've been in, I would say, "My name is Bill R. When I drink, I get into certain kind of problems, and now that I'm not drinking, I don't." And after a while, I realized if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, probably it's a duck. So I said I was Bill R. alcoholic. You notice now I don't say Bill R. I say Bill Rope. And the reason for that is, you know, we tell you how much we want to help you, and there may be somebody out there that needs some help with their drinking. And I'll tell you, just look up Bill R. in the Lawrenceville directory and you won't have any trouble finding me, see? But if you want to not help people, just go by the last name. Nobody won't help anybody. That's just my own idea. Guys like Don M., they don't do that. Bill W. didn't either. Pat W. didn't. A lot of them. In fact, I'm sort of a minority. Anyway, Clancy and I. No, he's a minority too. Anyway, so I started going to this Homewood 17, and what I did, I ended my period of sobriety. See, the 12 and 12 hadn't come out yet, or it had come out 5 years before, but the books hadn't made their way to Park Forest where I was, so there wasn't step meetings and that sort of thing. So I got into activity. Within 3 days of getting sober, I was on a 12-step call by myself, which is not the way it should be. But there was nobody else around. Everybody else in Park Forest was working. I was the only one around during the day. So I went out on a call, and the first guy I 12-stepped never did get sober. Died drunk, lost his big house, lost the Cadillacs, lost everything. But I stayed sober. And I asked my sponsor, "What am I going to tell this guy?" He says, "I've only been sober 3 days." He says, "Tell him how you stayed sober 3 days. And then get him to where the message is. Get him to the meeting. That's where the message is. You don't have to tell them about AA and explain the whole history of it. Just tell your story and get them to wear the message, and God will have somebody talk to them." So that's what I've been doing for 46 years. Now, you know, there's a lot of principles on this program that we try to espouse and certainly follow. And one of them is honesty. Rigorous honesty is one I love. I've never met anybody with it, but I think it's a great ideal. But when I came on the program, right after, and Bowen was around, and Knievan, if you doubt me, you can even check with Bowen. A fella who came on the program a year or two ahead of me, he was an airline pilot. And he told everybody when I came on the program that I have the Congressional Medal of Honor. Now, I don't have, and I didn't then, and I don't plan on getting it, but people would come from the group that he used to go to in Park Forest, and they'd say, "Bill, I understand you had quite a war record. I'd like you to tell us about it." And I'd say, I just as soon not talk about it. I not only was a hero, I was a humble hero. And then some girl in AA, Chicago girl, of course, came up to me and says, "What's this Congressional Medal of Honor BS?" And I said, I don't have it. But I had it for 6 months in AA, and that's longer than you guys had it, see? So honesty didn't come just because I came in AA. In other words, me and many people I know live the old story that when you take a drunken horse thief and sober him up, you got a sober horse thief. But he's better off than if he's drunk, because it's the only chance you have to get sane. If you start drinking again, you're dead. I was on a program a year or so, and I went to my sponsor. I said, I'm not going to make it. He said, why did you drink? And it's an amazing part of my story. I used to drink every day, get drunk two or three times a week for the last 4 or 5 years of my drinking. But from the day I made that call from Mary Breckenridge's house, I have not had the urge to take a drink. God removed it from me, even before the two guys showed up. So I didn't think it was a big deal. He said, did you have a drink? I said, no, I didn't have a drink. I don't drink. And he said, you know, you may not know this, but most alcoholics drink. And as I mentioned at the beginning, 20 million people are alcoholics, 2 million sober. That means 9 out of 10 people are going to die drunk. He says, anytime you go to bed at night and you're sober, you're a miracle. You're a winner. And I'm so happy you told us, see, because I was a loser when I came here. I was a graduate of DePaul, as I used to, Don used to like when I tell about, I'd go in the bar and I'd talk about some of our classes in DePaul in philosophy. We had one class was a class in ontology. Ontology is the science of that which is as against that which is not. And you know, most bars, you just become a big hitter when you start talking like that. I turn to the Irishman next to me and say, you want to talk about ontology? And geez, get out of here, you know. But anyway. So I didn't get honest because I put the cork in a jug, but I got active. I started meetings. I started a picnic. I never started anything. What happened is all these guys are old and I would start these things and then they disappear. And I'm one of these guys that just stays there like an old horse that's been tethered. You know, okay, put another saddle on. Let's go around again, you know. So I end up leading all these damn things, see, and meetings and activity and speaking and all that sort of stuff. I'll give you one last story, one drinking story. My wife and I were sitting in a bar in the Dawn Club, and I was selected to go over and get a pizza in Chicago Heights. And Chicago Heights is an Italian community run by the mafia, and nice people. They just got little daytime jobs and nighttime jobs, different than most of us, you know. But very good people, hardworking. And so I go over to Chicago Heights to get a pizza. And as I go to the Heights, I'm stopped. Two cops, one cop from the Heights, one cop from Park Forest, they stop me. Guy from the Heights says, get out of the car. Well, I can't get out of my side because I'd loaned my car to a drunk in a bar. He came back, he said, well, I had a lax and we dented the door in on your side. I went out and looked and it was dented. I said, that's okay. So I was a salesman, so all I did was park the car so they could see the good side. They could see I was a successful salesman, you know. Didn't bother me, just went back telling my lies. And I couldn't get out, so I had to get out this side. And as I got out, I looked up, and this cop's got, in Chicago, they used to have a little leather strap with a lead weight in it. You could take that thing and flick it, and you could break redwood tables. We had friends that were policemen, and we learned how to do this. And boop, in a picnic. And this guy's about to do this to my head. I duck, and he hits the top of the car, and I come up underneath him with a karate chop, and down he goes. And I'm looking, and the cops are screaming. One guy's trying to get at me. That's the Chicago Heights cop, or Chicago Heights cop. And the other two cops are trying to stop him from getting at me. And I'm just looking at this guy, because I was trained in hand-to-hand combat, and I'd never seen it work. So now we go over to Park Forest. As we drive into Park Forest, I'm not driving, of course, I'm in a squad car. He's driving my car, and they tell me this story. He comes down 26th Street, zooming into Park Forest, sees a red light, comes up, turns it on a brake. He goes right through and almost gets killed. See, my car worked. If you wanted to work the brakes, you pumped it. If you wanted the window again, I tapped it, it would fall. And if it was raining, you'd tap the window, reach around and grab the windshield wiper, go, shh, 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 shh. So my car worked, but you had to know how to work it. And he never learned how. So, anyway, all he had to do was walk, put your fingers together and walk a straight line. If you could do that, you weren't drunk. Great. I did that, and I was released. Now, they still impounded my car in Chicago Heights. So the one cop is driving me home to my place in Park Forest, and being a lawyer, I told him, being a lawyer and drunk, I told him, he said, Mr. Roop, I would have sworn you were drinking today. I said, well, it's too late now because there's such a thing as double jeopardy. A man cannot be tried twice for the same crime. I look down, I'm in handcuffs. Now I'm in the Chicago Heights jail. Won't do any good to being a lawyer over there, so I become a member of the mafia. <laughs> 1 o'clock in the morning, the chief of police comes down. I'm yelling and screaming. I knew who the mafia head was. He must have called them, because the next thing you know, they brought my car back, and they released me. So I drove back to the Dawn Club, got back there at 2 o'clock in the morning. As I walked in, everybody looked at me and said, where's the pizza? I was having so much fun drinking, I came in AA. Got better then. Jesus, got better sober. You bet you got better. I never had an accident when I was drinking. The reason Bowen thought I was dead is because I did take a English Triumph and run it in the side wheels of a locomotive going 45. The locomotive was. I was only going about 40. Kaboom! Rolled me over down the tracks. This is sobriety. Never happened when I was drinking. Everybody going into Chicago to work. Big crowd around me. A cop comes up. I'm covered with dust and I got blood all over me. He says to me, are you the fellow had the accident? I thought he was very perceptive. He picked it up just like that. And I said, yes. He says, then you're in shock. And I said, no, I've been in shock. I know what shock is. If it was shock, I'd say, no, no. He says, you don't understand. He explained to me that a fellow has this. He's in shock. I said, well, if I'm in shock, will you pick up my papers? He said he would. So he picked up my papers. I went into shock and had a cigarette, you know. Then he's got to take me over to the hospital in Chicago Heights, St. James Hospital. They keep you for 24 hours to make sure you're all right. And as we're coming down Route 30, coming into Chicago, we get a red light. Cop's got his light on. He's got a red light. See it? I look over here to a woman. She's in a white Chevy. She's going about 45. She's got a green light. We're going to get killed. I yell in his ear, stop! He hits the brake. The woman goes shooting by. And the cop went in the shack. And I had to drive him to the hospital. That's what sobriety does. If I had to stay drinking, I never had any accidents, you know. Work-wise was picking up. I became a manager. Oh, nothing. One of my friends, John Houlihan, who is now dead. He and I used to tell. The only thing, when John was telling war stories about his Marine escapades on Guadalcanal, he was telling the truth. I just shared some lies with him. I thought that made a common bond. John and I became great friends. He blew his leg on Guadalcanal. He ended up having 10 kids. I always told him if he hadn't have blown that leg, he could have had 20. I think it slowed him down. But at any rate, one night John and I were outside the AA meeting, and John said to me, he says, Bill, I can never work in a political office again. Because John was a nice guy. He worked in the public recorder's office, and they kept deeds and all that. And he'd come in with a briefcase into the bars, and if you need a marriage light, he'd sign you one and give it to you. You need a driver, he'd sign and give it to you, and you just pay him. He never was turned in or anything, but he kept a little extra money for John, and we could drink at the bar, you know. Well, daily his uncle found out about it and fired him. Said, you'll never be in a Democratic organization again. And I've been fired for an innocuous little thing like commingling funds. That's a minor little thing, but I'm in the prison talking to guys that are in there for the same thing. But I was never persecuted. So I never would take your money, but if I was in a bar explaining philosophy to some good-looking woman and I spent my $5 and I had 100 other companies, I would go into partnership. And they frown on that, you know. In fact, I think it's even termed illegal, you know. Anyway. So I knew I could never work for a big company again because of what I'd done, and he never could be a politician. 2 years later, Jan was an elected representative in the state of Illinois, and I was a district manager with McGraw-Hill. But that night, neither one of us could have been it. But the miracle of AA is by coming here, working with others, getting out of self, straightening out your life. There's no limit where you can go. If you want to pay the price, that's the message of AA. Now, you notice I haven't talked much about the big book. This guy Jay knew the big book backward and forward. We used the big book, but didn't have the meetings and studies and all that like we have today. So I said I was in my period of sobriety. Then I came down to Atlanta, and I think I came into my period of sobriety. I started going to step meetings. I started getting involved. I always worked with others, but I started getting more of the benefits out of the program. One of the steps in the program is talking about turning your life over to care of God as you understand Him. I'd like to make sure you hear this. When I took that step, I turned my life over to care of God as I understood Him, but I only gave Him certain things. Now, this is true. I've noticed this today. Some people still do this. They're wise like I was. See, if you're planning on dumping your wife and marrying some girl in AA, you don't want to take that to God. See, because you sort of got an idea that old gray-haired guy will probably say, don't do it. He's probably got it written somewhere. Not in any courthouse but today, but it'll be written somewhere, see. So you don't want to go to God. So I let Him take care of little things like, well, whatever the little things were. So I was always plugged into God. In fact, I was plugged in before I hit that train. I could see the train, I was going to hit it, and I said, God, it's yours. So whatever I'd been doing had been enough to turn it over to God. And it got me out of the accident without anything but a little cut thumb. So I was using God, although I was only using Him when I needed Him, you know. I was going to a whorehouse one day, and I was driving with God on my side, you know, and I said, God, I'm going into this whorehouse. I don't think you want to come in here, so why don't you listen to radio? You laugh. You think that's funny, you know. Don Millar told me that. I'd never been to a whorehouse. But we all have our whorehouses. Uh-oh. It's April 15th, time to do a little income tax. Hey, God, why don't you have a Coke? I'm going to do some creative figuring. Or I'm going to do an expense account. God, why don't you go over and help somebody that needs help? I'm going to do my expense account. See, today I'm plugged into God. See, I used to be plugged into God like my light was plugged into the wall. My lamp is always plugged into the wall. But the lamp is not always turned on. Today I try to keep my lamp turned on. Why do I do that? If you're a very capable, intelligent man and do very well running your ship, I guess you don't really need to use God as much as I do. But if you're as stupid as I am, you want a can-do God to plug into when you wake up in the morning. Before I get out of bed, I say loudly, thank you, God, for my life and my wife, and I mean it. I've been saying that for probably 20 years. At the beginning, my wife liked to hear it. She still likes to, I think. But you notice what I was doing before I got out of bed. I was plugging into God. See, before as a commissioned salesman, I'd think, my God, I got a guy cancel. I got to pay his money back. I've already spent it. I got to go and make a sale. You know, before I got out of bed, the day was ruined. So now I plug into God. Another thing we do, we put out the armor of God, wife and I, in the morning. If you're smart, you probably don't need God as much as I do. And when I was younger, I was smarter. When I was new on the program, I was quite smart. But the longer I'm here, the dumber I get. And the more I need God. I need a can-do God. Some of my people my age are having difficulty with health. Even burying some of them. As Mr. Steve. And I've got to know that I want a God that can do things. I know the power of prayer. I didn't learn it really in church. I heard it in church. See, I have never really learned anything in AA that I didn't already know before I came here. But I never thought of using it. I never thought of making it a part of my life. I thought these things you learned, you studied, so if you had a course in moral guidance, you'd get an A, you'd know what to say. But I never lived that way. So slowly, God has allowed me to try to be a part of Him and have Him a part of me. Now, what has it done? My wife is Dan, and Joan and I were laughing at dinner tonight. My wife and I have been fighting almost as much as the battling malars. And we've been doing it longer. His pigeon, his sponsor, Ross Wilson, was a wonderful fellow. He came over to our house one time. We lived in Buckhead, and he said, "Bill, I'd like to have you and Jan sort of sit down and counsel my wife and I. We fight a lot." Well, he made a mistake. He came over at 9 o'clock in the morning when Jan and I were having our morning fight. He says, "Have you ever thought of going to marriage encounter?" I said, "Why would we do that? This is marriage. This is love." See, marriage is different to different people. Jan and I have been married over 60 years. I love that woman more desperately than I've ever loved her in my life. Always loved her. But many times I was going to dump her and not have her tie me down. That's stupidity. But today we become one flesh. It's not a burden having her. The burden would be if she wasn't around. We tell each other we love her and we mean it. That's what AA did. But a lot of it is just staying. Just staying. I say that I'm not against divorce. People get divorced for many reasons. We just didn't. We would have got, people ask me, "How do you not get divorced?" I said, "Well, first you have to be broken, have five kids." Jan used to say, "Who the hell's going to marry me with five kids? That beats the hell out of me, you know." But they don't seem to want to give up all their money and adopt a bunch of kids just to stay married. But that's the way it's been in our life. How's it worked in our family? Well, we got a son that's got over 20 years. Got a grandson that's got 6 years in AA. It's been a big part of our life. There's love in our family. We've got a family that sticks by each other. We've got a family that loves each other. Is that the way AA should have worked? I don't have any idea how it should have worked. All I know, that's the way it's worked. And I'm so grateful that I called Alcoholics Anonymous on January 3rd, 1957, and I haven't had a drink since. Now, when I came down here, and I used to tell people, if you don't take a drink, your life will get better. A guy from New York said, "There's something you ought to add to that, Bill." "And what is it?" He said, "If you don't take a drink, your life will get better. And if you work the steps, you'll get better." See, the steps aren't at the beginning of the big book. The steps are chapter 5. The big book starts out with Bill Wilson says, "I'm a drunk." He tells about it. Then he says, "But there is a way out." Then he's going to tell you more about alcoholism. And then he says in chapter 4, he says to the agnostic, he says, "This is a problem with this. This is a problem, a spiritual problem. We're going to talk about God. Before you even get to the steps, you've done all this other." So now I see in my case, I was the way it was supposed to be for me. I got active. I was helping people. I was working. I was getting out of self. But change is slow. Change is hard. And I'll close with one thing, that every time you think you're walking on water and you really got it made, a while back, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I would sit in front of the TV and watch Bill Clinton on the TV. I would yell at him, "You no good, you know." My wife said I was crazy. I made a mistake. I called that woman, Mary Breckenridge, up. I started telling her about this rotten Bill Clinton. She said, "Bill, I don't understand why you're upset. He sounds just like you after 3 years of sobriety." I went back and did an inventory, and I said, "Gee, how are you, Bill? How's it going? How's the senator? Getting good money for your talk? That's great. How's the kid? But you know what? I'm free." See, we learned about resentments when we came in. And then all of a sudden, after years later, in a different voice, you got another resentment that's going to kill you. And the problem is not they. The problem is me. As long as they are the problem, I'm dead. AA is a victimless society. The answer to anything is me. On my mirror at home, I've got a sign. You're looking at the problem. Because I can change me and my attitude with God's help, but I can't change you or anybody else. So this has been a wonderful school of learning, not just to get grades, but to learn how to live with Bill Roop and love Bill Roop. In the Bible it says that a man who can overcome himself is greater than a king who can overcome a city. And that's what we're trying to do here. Put the cork in a jug, and you're whatever you are. You're the sum total of all your experience. And slowly, if you want to follow our way of life, based on my experience, with God's help, there's no limit to what can happen. I want to thank you so much, and I just love this prepaid. I think it's great what we've done. I'm glad I was given a chance to kick it off. I won't be able to stay because Jan and I are going to have to go. But I hope you have a great time. And remember, you're part of the greatest organization in the world, and all you got to do is not take a drink. Bye-bye.